Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, of the many victims of Nazi atrocities and genocide, one group's invisibility has recently been more unveiled. Members of the LGBTQ community. What did lesbians face? And how did this fit within the treatment of women more generally in Nazi Germany? Doug Becker explores with the author of a new book on the topic. And first, what are the regional implications of the Israeli and American war on Iran? Will it draw other countries into the conflict? What are Turkey's interests in the war, particularly with regards to the Kurdish people being armed to fight Iran? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The Israeli-American war against Iran continues, and it's increasingly becoming regional with the potential of becoming a world war. Now, one of the proposals the U.S. is apparently considering is arming the Kurdish population in the northern part of Iran to serve as ground forces against the state. But this decision would have significant regional implications. Turkey's opposition to Kurdish independence has that nation prepared to intervene should the Kurds be used as forces against the Iranian state. And Turkey's broad interests in Iran and in the region have compelled former Israeli Prime Minister and current candidate in a future election, Naftali Bennett, to suggest that Turkey is the next Iran. Today, we discuss Turkey's interests in the conflict and the potential it can be drawn into the war. Our guests today are Serhan Al. He is Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at İzmir University of Economics in Turkey. He's also a lecturer at Ohio State University. He's the author of Human Security versus National Security, Kurds, Turkey, and Syrian Rojava, and is Turkey ready for the post-Erdogan era? Roadblocks to a democratic transition. And Mohamed Humayunvash. He is founding director of the Jaffer Institute for Interfaith Dialogue and Education at Miami-Dade College. He is the author of Iran and the Nuclear Question. I want to thank you both so much for joining us today. And Serhan, I'll ask you the first question. What is Turkey's interests in Iran? What ultimately is the Turkish foreign ministry, the Turkish military, what are they watching with respect to this war? And what are their concerns?
Thank you, Doug. Thanks for having me. It's good to be back to Scholar Circle after a couple of years. So, I mean, just a quick historical background, Turkey and Iran, right? I mean, going back to the Ottoman Empire, they have been neighbors for centuries, basically. One is the Sunni power, the Ottoman Empire, and Iran is the Shia power. And in fact, if you look at the Safavid Empire since the 16th century, there has been even a Turkic influence in Iran as well. And currently the Azeri population, Azeri minority in Iran. So we are talking about two countries, neighbors for centuries, and there has not been a big war in the last couple of centuries. So, I mean, they are rivals in a way, the Sunni-Shia rivalry, but at the same time, they have significant trade relationships, significant energy relationships, significant tourism relationship. A lot of Iranians buy houses in Turkey. A lot of Iranians come to Turkey for vacations. So there are deep cultural, you know, economic relationships. However, I would say that, especially considering the Islamic Revolution and the Iranian regime since 1979, right, Iran went into a different path, an anti-Western, anti-American path. On the other hand, Turkey, as you know, is a NATO member since the 1950s. Turkey has the second largest military in NATO as a Muslim country, and it is the only Muslim country within NATO. So we are talking about two countries on different sides of the world, although they are neighbors. One is, you know, close to the Western alliance, basically NATO, the other is not. So Turkey would not want to see a strong Iran, Right. Turkey would not want to see a strong Iran, especially considering that this axis of resistance in the last couple of decades, the Shia crescent in the Middle East, right, from Yemen, Lebanon, Syria, etc. This was, of course, a threat for Turkey's foreign policy in the Middle East, since Turkey, especially under Erdogan, has been pushing for more Sunni agenda in the neighborhood, right? So Turkey would not want to see a very strong Iran in the region. But on the other hand, destabilization of Iran would create significant threats for Turkey economically, right? The energy routes. I mean, Turkey still gets gas from Iran. So economically, and particularly the Kurdish question, right? As you mentioned in the beginning, Turkey just dealt with the Rojava in Syria, right? It was a whole trouble for Turkey's sovereignty, Kurds pushing for more self-determination in the region. So it started in Iraq. I mean, after the US invasion of Iraq, Kurds created a autonomy in Iraq, and Turkey basically struggled a lot to create a stable relationship with the Kurds in Iraq. And so far, it seems reliable and stable. But if you look at Syria, the Kurds in Syria, from Ankara's perspective, seen as a threat because they were mostly affiliated with the PKK, right? The Kurdish fighters within Turkey. And it was just recently dealt with the interim President Ahmet El-Shara and Turkey, Americans, and the Kurds. So, in any case, Turkey doesn't want another, kind of a instability, especially in Western Iran, where the Kurds mostly live. So they don't want to see another Kurdish autonomy that Turkey cannot control, right? That's one of the Turkey's fears, that Turkey would be maybe okay to Kurdish autonomy in the region, but under the supervision of Turkey. And that was the issue in Syria. So this news that this in the CNN that the CIA would be willing to arm the Kurds in Iran, I would say, created a really big anxiety and fear in the Turkish public opinion and also in Ankara. So this is one part of the issue. The other part is that, of course, if Iran becomes weaker, right, and if there's any potential civil war, because I mean, it's not just the Kurds, it's the Baluchis in the east, it's the Azeri population in the north. So if there's any pathway towards civil war in Iran, there would be huge refugee flows into Turkey. And remember, with the Syrian civil war, millions of Syrians came into Turkey as refugees and migrants, and this created significant polarization within the Turkish society. I mean, the President Erdogan kind of pursued an open door policy to the Syrians because of this Muslim Brotherhood discord, right? But it created significant economic and cultural burden on Turkey. So I don't think Turkey can handle another mass level of, refugee influx or migrant influx from Iran. So that's another fear, right? And also again the economically and politically, I would say that again, stable Iran would be better for Turkey, but not too powerful, right? Not too powerful, because at the end of the day, these are two rival countries in the region. One is a Shia power, the other is a Sunni power, and there's also the Gulf in the game, right? I mean, Turkey is also to a certain extent rival with Saudi Arabia, rival with United Arab Emirates. I mean, when I say rival, I don't mean enemies, but they claim to be the regional powers in the Middle East, right? So, in this case, if Saudis or the United Arab Emirates, become militarized against Iran and become like militarily much more engaged with the US, this would be a losing stance for Turkey as well, right? Because Turkey has been, as a NATO power, has been the Americans, one of the first choices in the region. So on the other hand, I would say that Turkey would not want to see out of this war, out of this violence, would not want to see militarily more powerful Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates.
So, Mohammed, Serhan's laid out in many ways the fears that Turkey has about the nature of this war. Is Turkey looking at some opportunities here, though, as well? But I mean, obviously, if Turkey and Iran are rivals and Iran is weakened, that could really open the door for Turkey to become much more influential, couldn't it?
Well, Turkey sees some opportunity, but I think the risks well outweigh the potential opportunities that this might present, because I think Turkey's sort of nightmare scenario is the Kurdish folks being empowered via war, and this is, I think, the most dangerous outcome, where a U.S. backed Kurdish insurgency in Iran strengthens sort of transnational Kurdish networks, legitimizes armed Kurdish political movements, and inspires mobilization across borders. So this will obviously directly intersect with Ankara's fight against Turkish separatist movement, I mean Kurdish separatist movements inside Turkey. So what Washington sees as leverage, I think Ankara sees more as an existential threat. And the thing is that the Kurdish uprising in Iran is not going to be just a side effect for Turkey. It's going to be perhaps the main event if it spins out of control. And also, more regionally, I think there's that potential for regional blowback where fragmentation becomes contagious, and supporting ethnic insurgencies could fragment Iran along ethnic lines, and then it could sort of spill instability into Iraq, Syria, and potentially Turkey, and this could trigger retaliatory crackdowns and mass violence. So even critics, warn this could destabilize the region writ large rather than produce political transition. That's my long way of saying that fragmentation is easy to start, but almost impossible to contain. And in general, if the Kurds are being sort of instrumentalized and utilized as proxy for ground forces to foment, uprising and bring about regime change, history has shown that these types of operations are never clean. Regime change writ large is never clean, and it gets very messy once the state apparatus starts to sort of crumble. So I think from the United States and also Turkey's perspective, there's a strategic dilemma of regime change for the United States versus order. For Turkey, this is going to be a sort of weakened Iran, as you suggested, versus the possibility of spillover effect and its implications for stability regionally and even within Turkey. So I think both Turkey and the United States have a common incentive to weaken Iran. But this could risk destroying the territorial and political order that contains conflict, not only within Iran, but more broadly. And this could mirror past cases that we've dealt with, like Iraq post 2003 fragmentation, and Syria when it went through this multi-actor civil war that was incredibly messy. So history doesn't give us a whole lot of hope that this time it's going to be very clean and easily containable and manageable.
And you listen to Scholar Circle. scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're talking about Turkey's role, Turkey's interests in the Israeli and American war in Iran. Our guests are Serhan Al. He is from İzmir University of Economics in Turkey, and Mohammed Huma Yunbash. He's with the Jaffer Institute at Miami-Dade College. Now, Serhan, I quoted Naftali Bennett saying Turkey is the next Iran. And I read that and I think that sounds like it's as much of a threat as it is an analysis. Is that how Ankara is seeing this? That the potential that if Iran falls, that Israel could turn its attention to Turkey?
I mean, let me give a quick historical background again. Turkey and Israel has had significant trade and intelligence relationship, basically since the creation of Israel, right? Turkey was one of the countries that recognized the state of Israel in the late 1940s, early 1950s. And in fact, if you look at in the 1990s, Turkey's, war with the PKK, the Kurdish militants, Israel and Turkish militaries actually shared significant intelligence in the region, right? But that Turkey was much more, I would say, secular, close to the idea of Atatürk Secular Republic, much more engaged with NATO, the Western alliance. After Erdogan came to power, I mean, he started as a more, pro-European Union, somewhat a Muslim liberal, etc. But the things change, especially after Arab Spring, right? After Arab Spring, the Turkish foreign policy under Erdogan became much more assertive, right? In the name of, claiming this neo-Ottoman idea of making Turkey great again in the region. And the ideological background of making Turkey great again, or neo-Ottomanism, was the Muslim nationalism, like close to the Muslim Brotherhood's idea. And that's why during the Tahrir Square protests, I mean, Erdogan really supported the Mohammed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood against Mubarak. And in this process, of course, if you look at the Palestinian issue in the Middle East, I mean, in the 20th century, the Palestinian cause mostly embraced by the Arab nationalist movements, such as, Abdel Nasser and others. But when you come to the 21st century, it's Iran and Turkey mostly embracing the Palestinian cause. In the meantime, Arab countries, especially if you consider the Abrahamic Accords, right, in the recent years, trying to normalize with Israel. So Palestine, the Palestinian cause, has been, one of Erdogan's foreign policy tools and ideological engagements. And Hamas officials, have had offices in Istanbul and have had, a significant relationship with the Turkish government. There has been a very significant humanitarian aid from Turkey to the Palestinian people in Gaza. So this created, gradually significant tensions between Israel and Palestine. I mean, remember Erdogan's famous Davos meeting, right? After that, he didn't go to Davos, and it was a 1 minute moment, right? He was getting into this argument with Shimon Peres at the time. And when Erdogan came back to Turkey at the time, that he was greeted as a Muslim hero that challenging the Israel's power in the region. So it seems like the Israeli, intelligentsia, they see Turkey as a new representative of this Sunni Muslim identity with mostly anti-Israeli rhetoric. So I assume that's why, they mentioned that Turkey would be next after Iran. And this is, I feel like, a regional positioning, right? It's a signaling that, if Turkey attempts to, become much more assertive after Iran in the region, that Israel would not be happy about it. I mean, from Turkey's perspective, Even the idea of it is, dangerous for everyone. I mean, I would say again, let's remember Turkey is a NATO member and a very close ally of the United States. And also, I should mention that in Syria, after the fall of Assad, Israel and Turkey became head to head almost. I mean, when it comes to the Kurdish issue, when it comes to the issues of whether Syria should have a centralized authority or decentralized authority. So basically, today, Syria is a buffer zone between Israel and Turkey. But the Israeli military, of course, have access to the Syrian territories. Turkish military is basically in northern Syria, and the Damascus government has been very much influenced by the Turkish government, right? Some of the members of the Syrian government, they were educated in Istanbul, in the Istanbul or the universities in Istanbul. So there is tension out there, definitely. And I feel like this is kind of a posturing, signaling in a potential post-Iranian, Middle East. Because again, as I mentioned, this Abrahamic Accords was at least in a process of normalizing relations with the major Arab countries and Israel. So if Iran is weakened, Turkey, from the Israeli perspective, would be a somewhat, a rival. And the discourses are out there, right? I mean, definitely Turkish public opinion is very much, especially in the recent, war against Gaza, Palestinian people, and what's going on in Iran, and significantly created this anti-Israeli and anti-American, to be honest, sentiments among the Turkish public opinion. So, and President Erdogan would definitely want to use this public opinion to his advantage, right? So, military tension between Israel and Turkey, I don't know. I feel like the United, since this would be very detrimental to the United States as well, I feel like the United States would mediate between Israel and Turkey. But again, I mean, until recently, they had very close trade relations. I mean, economically, a lot of Israeli citizens came to Turkey as tourists as well. But this statement that Turkey would be next Iran shows that potential tension, potential new rivalries, and potential conflict is in the minds of a lot of people in the region. And I think it would be a lose-lose situation for everyone in the region.
Yeah, and Mohammed, I'll sort of ask you the same question there, because the idea of rivalry certainly makes sense, but what's the possibility of conflict, especially since Erdogan seems to be positioning himself, as Serhan described, as Islamic leader advocating, against Israeli positions, for instance, in Gaza? Could this be the next war?
It's very complicated because there is also this Eurasianist track within Turkish foreign policy elite, this idea that maybe Turkey could sort of extricate itself from the Middle East to a certain degree and pivot towards Eurasia, where a new security complex seems to be forming. So that's, I think, one thing to keep in mind. Also, another perhaps macro factor here is whether this conflict will accelerate the decline of the United States, comparatively speaking, compared to the Chinese specifically, in which case the United States might not enjoy the same leverage that it did before this conflict, broke out. So those are some factors that we also have to keep in mind. But I think Turkey is well aware of the fact that Israel's strategic ambition is towards becoming a regional hegemon. And so I think Turkey, again, is very well aware of the fact that Israel's current war strategy reflects more than just immediate security concerns, but it's a much broader ambition that might include Turkey, even though Turkey is, in NATO and whatnot. So in this case, Israel will try to degrade all major regional adversaries to include Turkey. to establish uncontested military superiority across the Middle East and sort of reorder the regional balance of power in its favor. So, if that is the case, then it will make sense for Israel to preempt threats before they mature. And Turkey, I assume, will belong to that type of threat. And to maintain escalation dominance and, reshape the security architecture of the region. So again, from that perspective, Israel's not just fighting the war, it's attempting to reset the regional hierarchy. And as Israel, an Israel that, emerges stronger from this war is not neutral for Turkey. It'll be very constraining for Turkey. From that perspective, I think Turkey does not want a weakened Iran if it means a dominant Israel. And so that's one thing to keep in mind. But also, I think Syria is part of this conversation because Turkey and Israel are already indirectly competing in Syria, with Turkey conducting anti-Kurdish operations and with Israel conducting airstrikes against some of those actors that Turkey might be aligned with. And if Iran is degraded, then Israel naturally gains strategic depth, and Turkey naturally faces a more complex operating environment regionally. And so, from that perspective, as Iran recedes, again, I don't think this is going to be the most likely scenario. I think this talk about, Iran not being a heavyweight in the region is probably premature, because we might actually end up with an Iran that's in much stronger shape, depending on the leverage it could sustain over the Strait of Hormuz. But let's, for the sake of this argument, say that Iran will recede as an outcome of this conflict. Then I think Turkey and Israel move closer to direct strategic friction, and the vacuum left by Iran will not obviously remain empty. It will be contested primarily between Israel and Turkey.
Our guests have been Serhan Al. He is Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at İzmir University of Economics in Turkey. He's also a lecturer at Ohio State University. He's the author of Human Security versus National Security, Kurds, Turkey, and Syrian Rojava, and Is Turkey Ready for the Post-Erdogan Era? Roadblocks to a Democratic Transition. And Mohamed Humayunvash. He is founding director of the Jaffer Institute for Interfaith Dialogue and Education at Miami-Dade College. He is the author of Iran and the Nuclear Question. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, Nazi Germany designated women as mothers who gave birth to the nation. What did that mean for lesbians? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. For Women's History Month, we turn to a specific culture of women in Nazi Germany. Given the roles for women being relegated only to wives and mothers there, how did this affect lesbians, and how did they resist the Nazi threat? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Nazi Germany's violence and genocide have had many different groups of victims, from Jewish, Roma, and Sinti, persons with disabilities. The violence was broad sweeping. But one group that until recently was largely forgotten, but these recent years, the veil of invisibility has been lifted as victims of the German Nazi state are the LGBTQ community. Our guest had written a previous book on the attacks on gay men and the role of gay men in the post-war Germany. We interviewed him in 2022. He's followed up with this book on a new historical account on attacks on gay women, on lesbians. So today, with an upcoming release of the book and in honor of Women's History Month, we discuss the Nazi campaign on gays and lesbians and their narratives of resistance. Samuel Close Hunekay is Associate Professor of History at George Mason University. He's written States of Liberation, Gay Men Between Dictatorship and Democracy in Cold War Germany, and his forthcoming I Will Not Abandon You, Queer Women in Nazi Germany. Samuel, thank you so much for joining us. I guess the first question, as I read the book that I thought was particularly fascinating, is to locate these attacks on gay women in the context of women in Nazi Germany. What exactly was the role of women in Nazi Germany, and what sort of challenges did women across the board face?
First of all, thanks for having me back. It's great to be here. So basically, the Nazis, so they're a fascist movement. They're an intensely patriarchal, misogynistic movement. And one of the really important things to understand about the Nazis is that their entire goal is to create what they call a Volksgemeinschaft, meaning a kind of cohesive racial community. And to them, this means a racial community made of Aryans, of Germanic people. And one of the key ideas for them, or one of the key sort of goals, is to increase the birth rate. They're pronatalists. They want to encourage young people to get married. They want to encourage women to have basically as many children as possible. And they actually dole out these sorts of honors to mothers based on how many children they have. So they basically see the kind of sexual and gender liberation of the Weimar Republic of the 1920s as completely wrongheaded. They think it was a mistake to give women the right to vote in 1918. They think it was a mistake to let women into the workplace and give them all of these new kind of economic and social opportunities. So as soon as the Nazis get into power, they try to start rolling some of this back. They fire many women, in particular married women, from their jobs. They make it increasingly difficult for women to get an education. They restrict the number of women who can serve as lawyers or doctors. And there are also various carrots. They create these marriage loan programs where young couples who get married can apply for an interest-free marriage loan and up to 1,000 Reichsmark, and those loans will be forgiven in quarterly installments for every child that is produced by this couple. And so it's interesting because on the one hand, women are seen as incredibly important to the Nazi project. They are the people who are going to be bearing and raising the future of the Aryan race. On the other hand, they don't really see them as anything other than vessels for the next generation. And so they're, largely deprived of economic, social, or political agency.
And I know the context of the rise of the Nazi Party was a period under Weimar Germany that was really, it was sexually libertine. It was almost joyous. You write quite a bit about Berlin, and it immediately made me remember that there's so many cultural references. I think of the play Cabaret, for example, that kind of reminding us, what that was like. So how much of Nazism was a reaction against, you mentioned the right of women to vote, but also this perception that there was a kind of a cultural loosening, sexual mores, and they were railing against that as kind of a socially conservative, it's, make Germany great again sort of approach.
Exactly. So it's certainly true that the Nazis were opposed to the sexual libertinism, right? So you both have the emancipation of women, you have increased visibility of queer people, of gay men, of lesbians, of trans people in the Weimar Republic, in particular in its big cities like Berlin. You also have the so-called new woman, which is kind of like the American flapper. It's the idea of this sort of young, employed, single woman who's going out on the town at night, who has short bobbed hair, is wearing either sort of very risque, small skirts, or conversely wearing sort of masculine attire. So the Nazis are certainly opposed to all of this. They make an argument that this is kind of a Jewish conspiracy to weaken the German race. The open question is to what extent they actually get votes based on this opposition. Historians disagree on this. I tend to think that, especially in the context of the Great Depression, which hits in 1929, people kind of lose patience for what is seen as a kind of decadent element of the Republic, and that it certainly plays a role in getting voters to consider non-mainstream parties like the Nazis.
I was struck by the number of narratives about women dressing like men. And so the book, suggests even the term, what, transvestite or trans or whatever. I mean, those are pretty modern, terms that have different meanings back in the 20s and 30s. And so could you talk a bit about what that means and sort of the challenge?
So when I went into this project, I was really interested in focusing on queer women, on female homosexuality, and trying to understand the interest that the Nazi state had in persecuting and sort of surveilling, punishing lesbians, and then also the ways that queer women kind of resisted that, or the kinds of lives that queer women had under Nazism. What I very quickly found is that it's actually quite difficult to disaggregate sort of queer cisgender women from trans people for a myriad of reasons. As you mentioned, transvestite is the term in circulation then. It doesn't have the same kind of derogatory connotations that it does today. People refer to themselves quite openly and happily as transvestites, and it means something that encompasses what we mean by transgender today, but it also can encompass drag, cross-dressing, a whole range of acts and identities. And so you'll find people who might self-identify as both lesbian and as a quote-unquote transvestite. And so in the lesbian subculture of Weimar Germany, and this then extends into the Nazi period, you have a large number of women who are going out to clubs, bars, balls, and so on in masculine dress. They might be wearing a tuxedo, they might be wearing a monocle. This is oftentimes referred to as a so-called garçon look, taking the French word. And as a historian, when you're reading these documents, it can be quite difficult to come in and say, okay, that person is a trans man, that person is a lesbian, and so on. And so, in general, in the book, I try not to do that unless I actually have evidence from the person themselves that suggests how they identified. And I think a really good example of this approach is the case of Ilse Totzke. They are an individual from Bavaria. They get into trouble with the Gestapo for a whole range of reasons, in part because they continue associating with Jewish people throughout the Nazi period. But their neighbors keep denouncing them. And some of the denunciations have to do with their continued association with women. And there's a sort of implication that they're lesbian. Other people keep, mentioning that they're wearing masculine attire. And in fact, some people even think that they might be a spy for this reason. And so, as a historian, I'm looking at all of this. I don't really have that much to go on from Ilse Totzke themselves. And so, I don't try to make a determination. They're clearly a queer individual. They don't fit into the sort of sexual and gender norms of the time. But I don't think, as a historian, I need to come in and make a determination of what their identity actually was.
Was lesbianism itself a charge? Because it seems like in a lot of your cases, again, mentioning, women dressing like men, the charge was espionage. How much was gay female culture, was lesbian culture illegal, and how much of it was kind of pretext to then charge them with something else?
That's sort of at the core of the book. So, female homosexuality was never illegal in Nazi Germany. There is a law, paragraph 175, that makes male homosexuality illegal, and that's where you get around 50,000 men convicted under this law in the Nazi period, and around 5 to 15,000 who are sent to concentration camps. For queer women, there is no one law. Now, first and foremost, that doesn't mean that people aren't turning other people into the police for this reason. I have lots of files of women who are denounced to either the criminal police or the secret police, the Gestapo, as lesbians. The charge when their neighbor or their family member even go to the police is this person is a lesbian. And that is enough for the police to then investigate. Even though this isn't a crime, the police will usually leap to their feet. They'll bring this woman in for questioning. They'll oftentimes go and interview other people in that person's orbit to figure out, okay, is there another crime that they're committing that we can then charge them with? And that crime might have to do with sex work. It might have to do with creating a so-called public nuisance. It might be a very weird German crime known as Kuppelei, which essentially means pimping, but really it encompasses allowing someone to engage in illicit sex. So there are a couple cases in the book of queer women who have married, entered legal marriages with men, and the men are then charged with this obscure crime of Kuppelei because their wife is having affairs with other women, and that is illicit sex, and the husband is sort of allowing it to take place. So, exactly, it's sort of a pretext to start an investigation that can then actually lead to very serious consequences.
By the way, with that, struck me that the number of specific cases of certain types of sexual acts and sexual kinks that we tend to think is are much more sort of modern, but were fairly common in Germany, husbands watching their wives having sex with other women.
No,
And so
certainly.
I guess as a historian, I mean, were you aware that in essence, Germany in the 20s and 30s may not really be all that different than the US in the 2020s? And a lot of things that we kind of assume are new really aren't.
No, I mean, that was something that kind of came through to me as I was doing the research for this book, is how modern or comprehensible these sexual tastes seem to be to us today in the 21st century. I will sort of add that in a lot of these interrogations, they're being conducted by the police, the secret police, by different sort of arms of the Nazi state. And one of the really scary, important parts of it is that they are incredibly detailed. They really want to know who is doing what to whom, when, how many times. And this is true both for queer women who are interrogated and also for queer men who wind up in front of these officials.
And you listen to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about a new book about the Nazi campaign against queer women, against lesbians. The title of the book is I Will Not Abandon You, Queer Women in Nazi Germany. And our guest is Samuel Close Hunica. He is from George Mason University. So one of the things that struck me is that the role that gay culture generally played in the early days of the Nazi regime. You suggested something that is particularly fascinating is that Hitler himself seemed to be fairly ambivalent about gay culture, or at least about gays, near him, because a number of the Nazis, most notably Ernst Röhm, was a gay man. So I guess the question is, I mean, if this was not derived from Hitler hating the gay culture, where did this come from in Nazi Germany, the opposition, the repression of gays?
My view is that to Hitler, this is of secondary or tertiary importance. He's certainly not a friend of homosexuality or queerness, but it is very much less important than this broader project of the Volksgemeinschaft, and it's certainly less important than his anti-Semitism. Basically, there's two kind of explanations. One has to do with the particular way that the early years occur in the Nazi period. They take power in 1933. By 1934, they've sort of settled into power. And there's one kind of burr left to deal with, and that is the stormtroopers, the Sturmabteilung or the SA. This is their huge, absolutely massive paramilitary force, and it's led by this man, Ernst Röhm, who's a close personal friend of Hitler's. He's also a gay man.
By the
And
way, this is what's known as the brown shirts, correct?
yes, exactly. Because they obviously wear brown shirts. And this is as opposed to the SS, who wear black shirts and are the other main paramilitary group. Ernst Röhm, he is a gay man. He leads this huge organization, millions of people. It's much larger than the official army at this point. And it's also stuffed with these kind of radicals who actually take the kind of social egalitarianism in the Nazi Party program seriously. So they are saying, great. We're in power now. Let's have a second revolution and let's now go after the industrialists and the bankers and all of the kind of capitalists who are keeping us oppressed. Hitler and the other leading Nazis at this point are buddy-buddy with these industrialists. They are buddy-buddy with the German military. And in fact, Ernst Röhm wants the SA to replace the traditional military entirely. Basically, Hitler and other top Nazis decide to move against Röhm. There's a purge, and basically an internal party purge known as the Night of Long Knives at the end of June in 1934. And it sweeps up all kinds of political enemies, including former chancellors. But the real target is Ernst Röhm and the other leaders of the SA. And they are arrested, they're rounded up. Some of them are killed immediately. One of them is actually found in bed with another man and is basically shot then and there. Ernst Röhm is taken to Dachau concentration camp. He's given the opportunity to take his own life. He refuses that and is shot to death by two SS officers. And it's a huge deal that they've done this. So Hitler has to publicly justify it. A couple of weeks later, he goes in front of the parliament, which is now just Nazi members, and delivers a speech justifying this purge. And one of the key rationales he gives for it is the alleged homosexuality in the ranks of the SA among the brown shirts. And he claims that there was not only rampant homosexuality, but that those gay men were in fact sort of in a conspiracy to overthrow the state, to overthrow Hitler. And this sounds completely nutty to us today, but it was taken very seriously. And so this becomes a constitutive element of Nazi homophobia after this purge. Basically, that gay men, first of all, are not, it's not congenital. It's the product of what they call seduction. So older gay men find younger men, teenagers, and seduce them into homosexuality. This happens particularly in all male homosocial settings like the brown shirts. And that if you get enough of them together, they'll form a clique or a conspiracy that can threaten social or political stability. And so you'll see, like, SS, the SS newspaper will describe gay people as enemies of the state or as trying to create a state within the state. And this becomes a core rationale for beefing up the persecution of gay men. The other kind of piece to the puzzle is that the leader of the SS is a man named Heinrich Himmler. He is known to us as a rampant homophobe. Unlike Hitler, he is deeply obsessed with any kind of sexual deviance or depravity in his view. And so he really makes it a key issue to go after gay people. He delivers an impassioned homophobic speech in 1937 to SS leaders, in which he bemoans that they don't have it as easy as their Germanic forebears because they can't simply drown gay people in bogs any longer. During World War II, he successfully lobbies Hitler to institute the death penalty against gay people in both the police forces and within the SS.
And that's, of course, part of what is now known as the Pink Triangle, right? That
Yes.
and I just found that fascinating in your description there, and the book goes into that, the very similar types of arguments, the grooming types of narratives that we continue to hear, even today. Now, I want to make sure to turn our attention and spend some time then talking about some of the individuals, some of the gay women that ended up being sent to concentration camps, ended up being killed by the state. How common was it that gay women were sent to concentration camps? And again, if having sex with another woman wasn't a crime, was there any sort of commonality as to the charges?
Yeah, so first of all, it doesn't seem like it was terribly common. Again, it's hard to know. We don't have good statistics for this because there's no single law. We can look at Nazi records of prosecutions under paragraph 175 and say, okay, this is how many people were convicted for being gay. And other historians have done very diligent work to sort of look at the Pink Triangle prisoners in the concentration camps to come up with a rough figure. There isn't a single sort of category for lesbian women in terms of persecution, and so we can't do that. It's much harder. That said, it does seem from the evidence we have, and this is something I go into in the book, that over time, persecution ramps up. And this happens across the board to all groups. As the Nazi period goes on, and in particular after World War II starts, persecution becomes much worse. We can see this with the Holocaust against Jewish people. We can see this with the Roma and Sinti, with Afro-Germans, with disabled people, with all of these groups. And so essentially, after the war starts, what you find with women is that more women are now working. In factories, on farms, in public transportation, to replace the men who have now gone off to fight on the front. And that spurs and some of these same anxieties, the same anxieties that Nazis have about gay men, they start having about lesbian women, that they're out in public, they're going to seduce other women into lesbianism, and they might even form conspiracies that could be destabilizing to society. And so you see more denunciations in this period from the evidence we have. You also start seeing more women who are denounced as lesbian being sent to concentration camps. And so one really vivid example of this, there are a couple lesbians in Berlin who are working for the Berlin Public Transit Service, and they are accused by their superiors, by their bosses, of essentially going and having sort of drunken orgies together with other co-workers at night. And then either not showing up for work the next day or showing up drunk, showing up late, etc. And so eventually they're turned over to the Gestapo, to the secret police. They're investigated for this and they're sent to concentration camps. And the only reason, basically, is that they've been having lesbian sex. That, however, is turned into sort of damaging the war effort because it is endangering public transportation in the nation's capital. What's interesting about them is that they're initially labeled as asocials, which is this sort of big amorphous grab bag category of persecution. And it's marked with a black triangle as opposed to a pink triangle. So they're initially labeled as asocials, but these two women are then reclassified as political prisoners. Again, presumably, we don't know why, but presumably because injuring the war effort was seen as a political crime.
After the war, was an assumption, of course, the Nazis had been defeated. And so the victims of the Nazi regime, first of all, could become normalized, expectation that laws would change and possibly be offered some, form of restitution if they had been imprisoned or family members trying to discover what happened to loved ones who were killed. How effective was that? I mean, were the laws changed and restitution embraced in post-war Germany when with gay women and lesbians?
In a word, no. So basically, as you say, there's efforts to have restitution after the war. And initially, my view as a historian is that this is all very cynical. It is post-war leaders who really just want to forget about the Nazi period, but they understand in order to be re-embraced as a quote-unquote civilized Western country, they need to offer some kind of restitution, in particular to Jewish victims, who are at this point kind of one of the chief recognized victim groups. And so they write these restitution laws incredibly narrowly in order to exclude as many potential victims as possible. And essentially, if you belong to any of these other so-called forgotten victim groups, asocials, Afro-Germans, Roma and Sinti even, basically it is incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to get restitution under these laws. I actually went and read through these restitution files for some of the individuals who I write about in the book. And first of all, they're deeply boring. These are sort of bureaucratic files at their finest, but if you get past the kind of boring bureaucratic jargon, they're heartbreaking because you have either survivors or the next of kin of survivors who are pleading with the German government to recognize that they're victims. And you have these really heartless bureaucrats who are finding any way to deny them. I mean, it's almost like, submitting a health insurance claim in the US today, in a certain sense. You have these bureaucrats who are looking to deny the claims. And one really good example of this, I think, is a woman named Waltraud Hawk, who I follow throughout. She's someone who's murdered in Auschwitz. And she's sent to the camps for a variety of reasons. She's lesbian. She's accused of being a sex worker. She's a person of color, and also comes from a communist family. So all of these reasons lead to her being sent to the camps and murdered there. After the war, her mother, who survives, starts applying for restitution. And the official reason that Waltraut is initially sent to prison is for so-called work shyness. And the bureaucrats become incredibly interested in this application and whether or not Waltraut had employment when she was arrested. And the absolutely cynical reason for this is if she was unemployed, then the arrest for being work shy would have been justified. And then in the German post-war West German bureaucrats' minds, her murder in Auschwitz would therefore have also been justified. And so you just have this really cynical, heartless approach to restitution that I think sort of proves or demonstrates that it actually took far longer for Germany to really come to terms with this violent past than I think many give it credit for.
And then also, since sex between two women was never illegal, but the paragraph 175, making sex between two men illegal in both books, you highlight this question. When was that repealed?
And I'll also mention gay men who try to access restitution also have no luck. In fact, some of the gay men who are put in concentration camps and survive the war are then re-imprisoned by the Allied powers after the war. So the law is first reformed in the late 1960s, 1968 in East Germany, 1969 in West Germany, to essentially legalize adult homosexuality, sexual acts between two adult men. But it still has a higher age of consent than for heterosexual sex. In the 1980s, it is basically fully repealed in East Germany. And then only in 1994, after the end of the Cold War, is it finally repealed fully in sort of unified Germany. And then you don't have full kind of the government expunging all of these convictions and offering restitution to anyone who's still alive until 2017. So this is, I mean, truly a decades-long process to try and get recognition from the government that you're a victim and then to get any kind of financial restitution for it.
If you were to draw any specific lessons from these historical accounts to issues today about the rights of LGBTQ, particularly in light of these sort of new right, populist, fascistic types of movements, what lesson would you hope we would take?
I think two. The first is a depressing lesson, which is that no matter how secure our rights seem, they can always disappear alarmingly quickly. And I think we have seen that in particular with transphobic policies in the US and really around the world. Just today or yesterday, the Olympic Committee announced that trans athletes would not be able to compete in the next Olympics.
And we're recording this on the 27th, on Friday the 27th.
And the sort of optimistic conclusion or lesson is that even in these times of persecution, even if you have governments set against you, there is still the possibility for resistance. There's still the possibility for joyful existence, and that queer people ideally should never lose sight of that and should never stop seeking to sort of forge bonds of solidarity and community with each other, even in the face of persecution and fascism.
Samuel, thank you so much for joining us, for sharing your time, your expertise, and this wonderful book.
Thanks for having me.
Samuel Close Hunekay is Associate Professor of History at George Mason University. He's written States of Liberation, Gay Men Between Dictatorship and Democracy in Cold War Germany, and his forthcoming I Will Not Abandon You, Queer Women in Nazi Germany.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.